Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. I think I kind of messed that up. I started speaking when you were, even though I'm always there. Just going crazy tonight.
Lyle's ideal out of a wild night is interrupting somebody.
In that case, like, every night's a wild night.
Burn.
So I guess the really big news for us is that the game Emergence succeeded in its Kickstarter.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been trying to cut down for your guys' sake, but I got to say it again. Woot! That's awesome.
All right, thank you.
It might sense make sense. Is that how we use that? Is that how we use Kickstarter in a sentence?
What, met its Kickstarter goal?
Oh, met its Kickstarter goal. Yeah, I guess.
Was Kickstartered?
It's now Kickstarted. In yeah. Action. Okay. So they achieved the very lofty goal of $20,000, which was that's a fair sum.
Mm-hmm.
So that means they should be able to produce a pretty decent looking book. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say I'm happy that they made it, but honestly I thought $20,000 was, as you said, Lyle, a pretty lofty goal. You know, I know there's a lot of fees and like for printing and doing art, but glad they made it, but am also sort of surprised that they did.
Well, likewise. I mean, even up to the last day, they still had a few thousand dollars to go, so I didn't really expect them to, but I'm very happy they did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's going to go into that extra money's going to go into the art. Because I know when they were talking about in case they didn't make it, then they would have had to maybe had less art in the book or something like that. So that's good if people have been on their website or the Kickstarter website and saw some of the art that's going to be in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely don't want to sacrifice that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I got to send my t-shirt size. You think I should say small or medium? I don't know.
I think you should go with extra large, just in case, you know.
So I could swim in it, yeah.
Or if it doesn't fit, you know.
Pass it on.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say pay it forward, but that it kind of reminded me of something that Wayne coined.
Oh, yeah.
Pay it backwards.
Yeah, pay it backwards. Somebody
actually, didn't I say, like, it's the reverse pay it forward?
Yeah. I didn't want to, like, get a team assist there, but yeah, I did help with that.
High five.
High five, yeah.
Someone stole Wayne's umbrella at the convenience store, so he stole somebody else's.
No, what happened is, like, I went to work without an umbrella, took one from the communal thing at the office,
yeah.
Went to the convenience store with you, came out, and someone had taken my umbrella,
mm-hmm.
that
which
I had taken
wasn't
from,
yours, then, though.
Which wasn't mine, that I had taken from someone else. So I paid it backwards and took someone else's umbrella.
Yeah. So
that's terrible.
Hey.
But, you jerk.
Know, a new term came of that.
Yeah.
Oh, I also got to send them my email so they can send me the beta stuff for Emergence.
Yes.
That'll be good. So then we talk about that. Another gaming news. I played X-Wing, the miniatures game.
Sweet. How was it?
Amazing. It is an amazing game. It is a really, really good game.
Hmm.
I believe if Lyle hadn't put that ban on woots, he would have wooted himself.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've played two games. Matt from the forums and I are tied at one game apiece. I've been playing the Imperials, and obviously he's playing the other guys.
I thought no Imperial on Imperial action.
So, no, it's like, I think what really does it is it's the hidden movement system.
Mm-hmm.
That they have, which is really good. Each ship you have has its own dial, and it mm-hmm. says what kind of movements the ship can make. So you choose what each one of your ships does, or what each one of your fighters does, and you put it face down. Of course, your opponent does the same. And mm-hmm. then, in ascending order, from lowest piloting skill to highest piloting skill, you start moving your fighters. So it's really good, because it's like you don't know how your opponent is going to move. So that's really interesting how that unfolds. But also then you've got to coordinate how your guys move so they don't run into each other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. And both games were really good. I probably enjoyed the game I lost a little bit more because I was able to do some more with my piloting and that. There's still a lot of options to tool up. I guess let's call it a squadron or series of squadrons.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can choose. I mean, the the types of fighters. I mean, you got the TIE fighter and the TIE Advance so far, and the Rebels just have the X-Wing and the Y-Wing, and of course there's going to be more fighters coming out.
Don't they have the A-Wing as well, too?
It's coming out.
Oh.
It'll come out with the Millennium Falcon Slave 1 and the TIE Interceptor.
Oh, okay.
But even with the two types of ship on each side, you still have a lot of options, because you can choose just like no-name ships, like no-name pilots, or you can choose special pilots, you can choose upgrades for the fighters and stuff. So it's a lot of fun. It's very quick to learn, reasonably quick to play. You certainly don't get bored. And the game can really, really seesaw, which is a lot of fun. You're never really out of it so much. Well, except when it was like 4-on-1, and then then it was pretty much Matt was left with a suicide run. So I really, really recommend it. And it's one of those things. I went all out and ordered 2 starters and all the expansion stuff.
Wow.
I won't be getting like the Millennium Falcon or anything, but I'm definitely going to make sure I get everything, all the Empire ships.
And,
that's really cool.
What hiding spot will you be putting them in?
Yeah, I don't know. I got to start like putting some stuff on eBay.
Yeah, my apartment is now off limits.
Oh, like I've hit a lot of stuff.
Please don't bring
the lies you're telling your girlfriend to the podcast. Yeah. This is Lyle's stuff here. Oh, you mean those 2 books on top of all those miniatures you have? Yeah.
I was just saying, the option at one time was there, and now it's not. All right, and that killed that.
I have nothing to add about your lies, Wayne.
All right, for our first episode after the month of horror, which went into November. Months of horror. We've started to do the anti-hero. So, I don't know about you guys, but one of my inspirations for this episode was, you've seen the TV series The Guardian?
Actually, no.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
You could tell us about it.
Well, it's the TV series The Guardian.
Please tell me all about this TV series.
And let me guess, it's a TV series about a guardian who guards things. Huh?
No, well, not exactly. It's about a corporate lawyer who gets arrested for drugs and then gets community service helping out kids. And just the character there, Nick Fallon, was like so unsympathetic, in many respects so unlikable, that it actually made the TV series better, because you're like, oh, we could have like a show about redemption.
Right.
And you kind of watch it, and you're like, well, oh, you've decided to go a different route. And you're just like, well, that makes it better, like more interesting. And like, you're following this guy, and he's in many respects a train wreck. And he's like somebody who's like been given it all. So you would resent a person like that, you know?
So it's almost like you enjoy watching him do this because you kind of want him to get his comeuppance?
No, you it is funny, like, you watch it and you enjoy the reality of it is that he's only going to grow as a character, just like, I suppose, like real life. People tend to only, you know, after a certain point in their life, they kind of stop growing and developing.
Right.
So he's not going to have this massive turnaround or
realization.
Realization or epiphany. And in fact, the series, which I really recommend, ends on an absolute downer. Which kind of...
Spoiler.
No, I don't say what the downer is, but but you're like, you think, oh, this is all feel good, you know, this like corporate lawyer is going to be helping out kids and stuff like that, and he doesn't really like the kids and stuff like that. He can't connect with people. He's very remote, repressed. And I was thinking about, what if you played a character like this? Like, what would that be like? I mean, it's easy to play the hero, and playing certain types of anti-hero certainly can be easier or fun, a lot of fun, but what about this type of anti-hero?
Not just an aside, but I kind of find it difficult to play the hero. Or maybe it's just because I don't really find those characters interesting. Because I've tried to play the classic good guy in both like video games and role-playing games, and eventually I just kind of hit that point and say, realistically, nobody would do this. You know? So.
Yeah, but in the same grain, I can see how playing an anti-hero could also be a pretty difficult task. Because, you know, with a hero, you just choose whatever the right thing to do is. And, you know, in a role-playing game, since it's not real life, it's much easier to choose to do that thing. But with the anti-hero, you have to walk a bit of a line. Because assuming that you're not going to go straight out into villain, you have to play somebody who does the right thing, but maybe just not the right way of going about it.
Doing some research for the anti-hero, they seem to be contrasting them, or like about a classic Greek hero, you know, the classic hero. But then you're thinking about, like, the Greeks. They're the original anti-heroes. Like Achilles and a lot of them. And probably Gilgamesh would even be, like, what we would describe now as an anti-hero. You know, they were selfish. They were human in many respects. The Norse gods, when we talked about them, they had all the virtues and vices of the people that worshipped them.
Yeah, I think when we did the episodes on like the Greek pantheon and the Norse pantheon, one of the things that came up was just the gods are larger than life people with all the flaws and weaknesses and failings that regular people have just on an even bigger scale.
And then when we were talking about like historical figures, like every historical figure in as many respects is an anti-hero, and it's probably a good time now to say what a traditional definition of the anti-hero is someone who lacks many of the traditional heroic qualities and possesses some of the villainous. So you're looking at like Julius Caesar, Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great killed one of his, I believe it arguably be his lover, in a fit of rage. And you're like, that's very human.
Mm-hmm.
So in many respects, playing the anti-hero is playing a human as opposed to playing an ideal.
I'm guessing people that back then didn't have spin doctors. Okay, how can we spin this, kill this lover in a jealous rage kind of thing? All right.
It's tough because the definition does change over time. I mean, when we talked about the Greek legends and myths, we talked about how the Greeks valued kind of an all-around guy, a Renaissance man who can do anything. And that includes being, you know, good at making moral decisions, but also good at deception, good at lying. So, yeah, but I mean, by our definitions, even more so.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And then the anti-hero kind of got redefined. Well, I guess the Greeks just called them heroes, but with, like, Lord Byron. In the Romantic Age with the Byronic hero. And that was going to be one of our subtypes, but then we realized that there's a lot of qualities that you can actually break off and make into different subtypes. And there you're looking at, like, Heathcliff and Wuthering Heights and characters like that. I guess the Count of Monte Cristo could be that. So what we've done is we've broken up the anti-heroes into different subtypes. Well, we'll try to give, hopefully, a more iconic example than Nick Fallon of The Guardian. Which may have sent people to Google, as you know, somebody you can hang on to, and kind of like what would be good about playing these characters, and also just like some cautions, because as we've talked about in other casts, it's like sometimes, you know, I mean, you're playing with other people, so
yeah, only push being selfish so far.
Yeah. Oh, and since you mentioned it,
all right.
Our first subtype is the selfish hero. I guess an iconic character would be Han Solo.
Han Solo, Gordon Gekko.
Yeah, I was going to say Han Solo before George Lucas changed everything.
Really?
Well, the Greedo shooting first thing.
Yeah, I mean, him shooting first makes him more of an anti-hero than him firing in retaliation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You have like Scarlett O'Hara or Holden Caulfield, I suppose. Mm-hmm. All characters I'm sure you want to introduce into your game. How do I make a dress out of drapes? I think this character is in many respects really unsympathetic.
They can be, and I think that's one of the difficulties or one of the dangers in playing a selfish anti-hero is that, yeah, they are kind of unsympathetic because they're doing everything only for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's plenty of ways that like a game master could motivate that kind of character or that player or get them involved in the story. Maybe they're one of the easiest kind of anti-heroes to get involved in the plot because you just threaten something they want and they should be all over it. But it also makes them kind of despicable and difficult to work with as a team.
Well, thankfully, the way a lot of some of the older RPGs, and I'm thinking D&D specifically here, is set up, the selfish hero, or a selfish anti-hero rather, blends in right along with just a regular hero. Because you get so many benefits. You get the treasure, you get levels, you get power, in addition to, you know, helping save the town. But, you know, who cares about that part? I get experience!
Yeah. Actually, when you hear the stories of how they played those early D&D games, like Gary Gygax and the people he played with, they were all pretty much like selfish anti-heroes.
Yeah, I don't think it's that uncommon a trait to find in players.
Yeah.
All right, maybe we should just say, okay, you know how to play this one.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think people do.
Yeah, I guess, yep, yeah, probably you're right. It's like, what's in it for me?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that many a DM has, or game master has encountered that problem where the players immediately say, what's in it for me? And then you gotta, like, pour the honey on, mm-hmm. just to get them to participate something. And it's like, well, how about a game?
How about enjoying your Thursday night with your friends? Come on.
Are we talking about the character or the player here?
My motivation, you know.
I think like this can run into some trouble if one of your characters is playing a selfish person, whereas the rest of them are trying to play heroic. But I think the interplay between the characters can make for a lot of fun as well. You know, everyone else wants to go out and save the town despite there being no tangible benefit to it. And this one guy says, no, I don't want to do that. How do you get him to go along?
No,
or you just kick him out of your group.
No, I think you really hit upon what can make this a really rewarding character to play, and not only for you but for the other players, is that, well, I mentioned it before, Takers, that mm-hmm. movie. And, they have a line, you know, we're takers, that's what we do. And it becomes, this is more traditional, like, greedy selfish, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it limits how much you can trust other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, hey, we're all takers at the table, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you all want to play like selfish anti-heroes, so play that up. You know, no one can really trust each other, and everybody's trying to like do what's best for them, and then it becomes like a game within a game.
Oh yeah.
Or you could do the selfish character among the other ones, mm-hmm. among the normal characters, we'll say, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a lot of clash. So whereas with everybody selfish, there's understanding, perhaps too much understanding. Mm-hmm. You know what the others are going to do to you. And in the other respect, there's clash. So then you also have to bring something else.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have this deficiency, you're not an anti-nothing. You're an anti-hero. So what else are you bringing to the table? Is it a skill set? Is it a relationship with another PC? Or, you know.
Yeah, that's a really great point, Lau, because that's something that all of these anti-heroes, they're almost by definition, they're not extremely sociable people. So there has to be an additional reason as to why they're, for lack of a better word, allowed to stay in the group. And that's something that's very important, because the play between that ability or that skill set or that relationship versus maybe just their personality going against other people can really bring out a lot of fun in the game.
That's kind of what I was going to say. Like, if you're going to play a selfish anti-hero in a group of quote-unquote normal people, then you have to make sure the character kind of has a reason to be there and has something that he or she can bring to the table. Otherwise, why do they keep you around?
Yeah, exactly. And one other thing to say is, actually, you brought it up there yourself, Lyle, with saying if everyone's playing a selfish character, kind of like a circle of thieves, again, the example being Takers or Heat or an admittedly shallow one. The name just left my head. Wait, what is it, Wayne? The one with the five guys, the competence porn?
Leverage.
Leverage, thank you very much. Because all at the end of almost every season of Leverage, they all kind of finish the job, and since they're all quote-unquote selfish people, they walk away and the group breaks up. But, you know, that's something you can play with in a game, too. Once these guys, they're all together for selfish reasons, honor among thieves kind of thing, but once their job or whatever finishes, then kind of that selfish desire should drive them apart. But if the group stays together, there's a lot of potential there for growth as characters, perhaps even out of these selfish modes.
Yeah, I was actually debating whether or not to bring up Leverage, and I'm not sure if they're actually anti-heroes. I mean, they're not that way.
It's trying to play them up as that way, but they're not actually.
Because, I mean, like, they all start as selfish anti-heroes, right? They all are contracted for the job, and they all do that thing, and they all get the reward. That's the only reason they're together. But then, even right at the beginning, they kind of say, okay, well, all these other people are good at what they do, and I want to work with them again. And then, you know, you have that character arc where they become a real team, and they're working for the good guys. So they start out as anti-heroes, but then they become something else, which can be fun to play.
Or also could not work, and your players just end up walking away.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd want to... The growth part, I mean, that seems to be a traditional way to do the story, but whether or not you need to have that?
I don't know. I think maybe for longer games or a campaign, you would, I think. And people are free to disagree with me, but I think eventually, if people are only playing anti-heroes, you're going to hit that point where they say, okay, why are we still together?
Hmm.
So shorter games, yeah, sure, you don't have to have that character change, but I tend to think in longer games, you would eventually need to build up friendship and relationship within the group. Otherwise, it's just going to break apart, you know?
I can see it both ways. I can see there being the dynamism that I mentioned, but also the example you gave at the beginning, Lyle, with that attorney one, that's name I also forgot. Jeez, I'm terrible with names. What was it again?
Nick Fallon. Actually, yeah, I wouldn't say he, well, I suppose he is selfish, but I have him down as something else.
Okay, well, as an example, though, like, you say that he doesn't change. Like, he doesn't improve as a person, even though you would expect him to. And perhaps the difference between your expectations and what really happens is what drives the story. But, yeah, I mean, you can have somebody who just is despicable throughout. And, hey, if it's fun, go for it.
Yeah, I don't think Scarlett O'Hara ever changes.
No, well, sure, she doesn't.
Well, was it Tomorrow's Another Day?
Yeah, Gordon Gekko doesn't. He comes back for a sequel.
So I guess since we talked about Nick Fallon, he was kind of the inspiration for The Void, which is our next subtype of antihero.
Mm-hmm.
But probably a better, a more famous example would be Mad Max or The Road Warrior. So here's a person who's lost his family, and something's missing now in his character. He's like in many respects, a shell of a man, but he's still functioning.
Mm-hmm.
So when you watch, like, The Road Warrior and how he goes through that entire movie, you realize that this is just a person who has, like, things missing. He no longer relates to people in the same way as he did before.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's lost the ability to care.
Yeah.
Caring meter falling.
From Walt Disney Pictures.
You're laughing now. They might own him eventually.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty. I mean, it's a pretty famous movie. I'm sure most people have watched it, but I still don't want to watch it. But there, you don't see a lot of growth in his character,
right?
You know, you see him kind of like he kind of remembers a little bit of who he was, but I mean, in many respects, he ends the same way as he began in that movie.
Right.
Yeah. And I think this is like a really, really hard character to play because it can be, boring. And I actually read this about David Duchovny's, acting style. And, Chris Carter, the X-Files.
He has one?
Yeah, no, he goes,
I'm sorry.
he dares to be boring.
Hmm.
No, that's kind of interesting. You say, well, maybe he can't act, but.
Put it that way, it's a compliment.
Yeah, yeah.
I
think dare was in that sentence. But The Void, you should be not like crazy, you know, just like, oh, I, you know, the rules right. Don't apply to me. It's just
they don't care.
Yeah, you just really don't care, and it's very difficult to motivate this person. I mean, it's very difficult to motivate Nick Fallon, or difficult to motivate the Road Warrior.
Maybe the key to playing this character is building up that background story where you lost everything, and that explains why you are the Void, right? So the way I kind of see that working is, you have a reason for your character to be this way, so you're not just playing, you know, this guy to be a dick and screw everybody else over at the table, you know?
Well, that's also feasible.
that's also possible, but this way you at least have a reason to why your character is the way he is. And also, it gives you role-playing opportunities within the group while still being the Void. Because eventually, why you are, or why your character is that way, is going to come out. And your character is going to have to tell that story, either not reluctantly, but just in a way that shows they don't care anymore. And that will give the other players of the group something to play off of, that you have this tragic backstory or this backstory of, you know, where you lost everything. But it also gives you, the Void, something to play off in the fact that you're not going to really react. You just don't care anymore. So I think that's one of the ways, or a way, you would have to play it, where it is interesting because you can kind of leak that backstory out, you know, over a number of sessions and, you know, dropping little hints. But I don't know. I think that's how you would have to do it, or one way you would have to do it.
No, I agree completely, Wayne. I think that's one of the best ways that you could create a character like this. I'd like to add two additions onto it, though. One is that make sure that your backstory is something that can come out in play. Otherwise, there's not really a point in it. See our episode on Secrets and Lies for more. And the other one is to make sure that you give your character a motivation. Something maybe you can talk with your GM beforehand. You can make it something that's external, like he owes a debt to society for some kind of crime or something, and if he doesn't adventure or whatever, he's going to go back to jail. Or it could be some kind of internal motivation that you decide on, but give him a reason to go out and do what he's doing, even if it's not apparent or if it's deeply buried down in his subconscious. Otherwise, he's just going to end up sitting in a bar drinking.
Yeah, well, yeah, you definitely don't want to end up with your character sitting in a bar drinking, doing nothing. Or if you do, then it's like, okay, roll up a new character. You know?
I've got real life for that.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know. I was actually wondering, like, is the void motivated to actually do anything, or is the character just kind of going through the motions?
And that could actually be, you know, just inertia could be a motivation for it. I don't want to, because the void is a character that is callous, that lacks feeling. So I don't want to say that he needs some kind of drive, but at the same time, you've got to have something that's driving you to adventure, to move, and to not just sit around.
Well, yeah, I mean, hopefully some people have seen The Guardian. I mean, in that case, the thing that pushes him is, and he's not a sympathetic void at all. There is no, like, necessarily a tragic story that, you know, his family died. But he is now sentenced to community service. So that pushes him. And right. that could be, like, a very external factor pushing him. With Mad Max, I mean, he's just looking for gasoline and the next thing just to survive. It's not even enough to say that he's selfish or greedy. He's just moving from place to place, just,
you know, staying alive.
Yeah, staying alive, and you don't really know why he wants to stay alive.
Right.
You know, it's almost like some sort of reptilian will to survive or something. That could be it. It's just like the guy kind of moves in and somehow there's a deal. Like in Mad Max, there's a deal that he makes where he can get more gasoline and then it goes from there. The Guardian, there's some sort of prison sentence like a criminal sentence and it goes from there. So maybe like something like that.
So I guess that brings up the point kind of like with the selfish anti-hero. There is that possible arc where they kind of learn to care about something, or they, you know, realize that not everything is about them, and they can kind of make a transition to, I guess, a normal character. But could you do that with a void? Because I'm thinking, you said The Guardian ends on a downer, and I can speculate where, you know, once he's finished his community service, he's going to go back to being the kind of person he always was. And, you know, Mad Max ends where the deal is done, and he just moves on. Once that deal is done, or once that motivating thing is gone from the void, don't they just kind of move on? And
I
see it as being much harder to keep the void anti-hero around simply because they don't care anymore, and that is their character.
I think it's an excellent point. I know we've talked about like campaigns versus like, you know, short and sweet sometimes, and sometimes. Yeah, you should move on from a character. You know, like some characters are good for a limited arc, and then you can kind of wear out the welcome. It's like with The Void, I think that's an excellent example, because I think in those stories, The Guardian and the Mad Max, the Road Warrior, is that they're a void, and the environment proves them right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's really attractive about those stories. It's kind of a downer, of course, but it makes it an attractive story, is that no, it's, you know, people aren't good, you know, there's not really much of a point to do stuff, you know, you're not going to make a difference. The Chocolate War.
Right.
If people read the book as opposed to the movie, which both are excellent.
Hey, the movie was pretty depressing. I have a feeling if I read the book, I want to slit my wrist.
Yeah. And it's just like, yeah, don't try to change the world, because you can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just kind of that message. Why somebody would write that for young adults, I don't know.
hey, to show them how it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. But then it's time. Like, that person's got to move on, because, you know, it's like they've got this, you know, impression of the world, and the world just keeps proving them right.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to take that character. You could, of course, go with the stereotypical arc, and like what you said, where you expected for The Guardian to go, where he learns to love kids and he gains something in his life back. But you know what? That's not really true to the character. You know, keep them callous, keep them cold, and when they're done, they're done. Walk away.
And I think something that you could, you know, it's kind of an interactive quality you can give the void is, you know, cynicism, or they're jaded. And so that allows you to enter. I mean, to be a silent void is not very interesting, but somebody who makes those comments, there's a Kirk Vonnegut, I think it's Hocus Pocus, and they have a character, and his little tagline was his, you know, I have to laugh like hell. Or his catchphrase is, I have to laugh like hell. Even though he never laughs. And he's like tells these dark stories about Innom and that, and he's like, and I just have to laugh like hell. And it's somebody who's like kind of thinks of themselves as that one that's laughing at the world, just they've forgotten how to laugh. I don't know.
Right.
So yeah, the cynic, the jaded guy, I mean, or jaded woman, that could be pretty cool. Think about this as a cool line, you know, it's, Chinatown. Everybody's seen that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's Chinatown at the end. And you're just like, well, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And it's just like, yeah, that's it. That's it. That's life, man. Just move on.
Forget it, Lyle. It's Chinatown.
Oh, is it forget it? Is it, yeah, was it forget it, Jake? It's Chinatown?
Yep.
Yeah.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
Yeah, you studied film.
I did. And Chinatown as well. I actually wrote a paper on it. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, what's that mean? Does it mean like, that's just life, just go on?
Oh, yeah, exactly. There's nothing, you can't do anything about it. That's it. That's how it is.
Yeah.
It's actually probably the similar message to The Chocolate War, though I haven't seen that just from what you guys describe.
I think the message in The Chocolate War is just, why did you even try?
Yeah. Yeah, what was the point of that?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, The Candidate. You ever see that movie with Robert Redford?
Mm-mm. No, I haven't.
Damn, all of these great... You know, the great thing about The Void is the last scene. You know? If you talk about The Road Warrior, in many respects, is how he became The Void, right?
Right.
But a lot of these other Voids that are out there, the great thing about them is not the beginning, middle, it's the end. You know, that great line. And I think, you know, that's kind of a way to play The Void, is that in the end, you'll be proven right.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, there is no point.
Well, knowing that, like, in the end, you're going to be proven right, that means use your time in the campaign or game to come up with that really awesome closer as you just walk off.
Absolutely. I mean, you could do that. Yeah. You could be the, like, the traditional self-sacrificing hero, except for you, it's like, no, what's the point? Yeah, we're going to die. I'll die now. You'll die later.
Yeah, why am I even doing this podcast?
No, I think
because it's fun.
I think this is a really method character, and I think people who want to do this, I think because we're all a little bit selfish, you know,
a little.
And some of the other ones are pretty. They've got something pretty easy to hang on to.
Mm-hmm.
But I think The Void, you gotta watch some of these movies, and you gotta really think. Is like, you know, you gotta really get into that character, kind of that hopelessness, that bleakness, that. Yeah.
Fun.
I think a lot of beginning players also make this Void character almost unintentionally, you know, the I have no friends kind of character. Like, no family. But it's a bit easy to fall into it.
I didn't notice the part about history on the character sheet.
I have no background sheet. Be careful with it, though. It's a bit of an easy trap to fall into where, you know, vacuous is a little bit different from Void. Make sure that your character has a character, that he doesn't lack any kind of personality. That doesn't make for a lot of fun role-playing.
No, it makes for no role-playing.
Even Nick Fallon, there's a reason why he is. It's just, mm-hmm. it's a reason that you wouldn't think that is terribly sympathetic. You know, you're just like,
right.
Well, he's kind of been handed a lot. Oh, emotionally distant father? Big deal.
That's rough.
Yeah.
Get over it.
Yeah. Was your family run over by a biker gang?
No.
So, I mean, if things get too depressing, I guess you have the self-destructive character.
Which is somehow less depressing?
Are you advocating character suicide?
Yeah, that's what I was going for, yeah. And this is definitely something we took from the Byronic hero. It's just this quality where they want to destroy relationships around them. It's like a Void doesn't want to form relationships. Because what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
Or if they do form, they'll definitely keep that distance. But the self-destructive character can be very attracted to other characters and wants those relationships, but then wants to destroy them. Very self-critical.
Mm. Well, I was going to ask, like, do you think they do it consciously or subconsciously, or is there room for both?
I think there's room for both, yeah. Because somebody could think that they're not worth love or whatever they're trying to destroy, or friendship.
Mm.
So then they try to sabotage it. Another one's just kind of a jerk. But in a very dramatic way.
Oh, I am a jerk.
Forsooth. Is it just me, guys? Are we going through and describing all of the problem players at a table, too?
The difference here is it's the character, not the player.
Ah, I see. Cool, cool.
Big distinction.
Yeah, we're not giving people a license to be jerks.
Be a dick, yeah. Whoa, it's not me who was a jerk, it is my character.
Schlechter Byron wrote.
We wanted to talk to the king. Why did she have to try and kill him like that one? Oh, it's not me. Idle Red Hands recommended being self-destructive.
Self-destructive can be pretty frustrating for the rest of the party.
Mm-hmm.
In that they can keep messing things up. Like, they develop relationships with NPCs and then only to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
But it can also be a lot of fun because it does create a certain spontaneity.
Absolutely. Your campaign may not be controllable, but it at least will never be boring.
Another classic type of anti-hero is the vigilante. And here you would be thinking of the Punisher.
Batman!
Surprised you didn't do your Batman voice there, Chris.
Sorry. I'm a vigilante!
Oh, is that the Batman voice now? It's not the Michael Keaton?
I thought that was Leonidas' voice from 300.
Well, it almost is. Christian Bale just went nuts with that voice. But you know, now that you mentioned it, with Michael Keaton, it just kind of got stronger over time, huh? I'm Batman. Although
I'm Batman!
This is Gotham.
This is CNN.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, I like those movies, but yeah, I did get kind of annoyed with that voice.
Mm. Yeah, I like the one where he was kind of like sitting on a fire escape in the pouring rain, and he's kind of like yelling at the guy. And he's spitting his words so much that raindrops are just kind of like flowing off of his mouth and the guy's face.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Jeez, Batman, say it, don't spray it. Oh, that was old. Anyway, vigilantes, yes.
I think this is some like an anti-hero people can really just grab onto. I mean, obviously they have very heroic qualities in that they're fighting crime like any other hero.
Mm-hmm.
But... but of course they're breaking the law.
Mm-hmm. And you have varying degrees of it too. You have the Batman where he's completely against any kind of lethal force, and on the other hand, the other example, the Punisher, where he's all about lethal force.
I think the vigilante might be one of the easier anti-heroes to play because at least like certain types of vigilante anti-heroes, they are still good.
Mm-hmm.
They just have a different way of getting the results that are good. You know, like the classic example, as we always say, Batman, you know, he's working outside the law,
mm-hmm.
but nobody, none of the viewers, right, none of the people who are kind of familiar with him ever really question that he is good.
I don't know, this is maybe a bit of armchair sociology or whatnot, but I think this comes a lot from kind of American cinema. You know, the mythology of America is about like the cowboy spirit, the vigilante thing. It's not up to the law. It's up to me to pull myself up by my bootstraps and take care and do what's right. And I think that because of a lot of these stories, the vigilante idea has gotten really popular, and it's just something that's really widely accepted in society as a heroic character, even though it's not the Dudley Do-Right.
Yeah, Yeah, I think this is the anti-hero that's probably the most difficult to distinguish from any other person at the table.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because in many respects, all of the characters would operate outside of the law. I think, if anything, the vigilante is giving them more heroic qualities than the vampire you have in the World of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Or the adventurers that just, you know, go through and loot dungeons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's giving them a cause. A heroic cause with their unorthodox methods. And, you know,
yeah.
Normally the players would just have the unorthodox methods.
I don't know. I think maybe part of the reason why it's so hard to differentiate the vigilante anti-hero from the hero is because most vigilantes are portrayed in a setting where the system is either corrupt, doesn't care, or is prohibited from acting. And so... You know, the vigilante takes matters into their own hands, but they're kind of always seen as good. You know,
yes,
because
exactly.
The system doesn't work. And so they are, you know, like we the viewers or the people watching are What's more looking for? We excuse the vigilante for his method because working within the system would essentially be bad, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to say, Wayne. Very, very well put.
So I think you can kind of like turn that on its head, or not turn that on the head, but make it a much more difficult choice for the players and say, no, the system works. You know, everything maybe doesn't work perfectly, but the system works. Nothing's really wrong with it. And are you still going to be a vigilante?
But then what's the point of being a vigilante? If you're following the law, if you're doing the right thing by breaking the law, but the law happens to agree with you because the system works, then you're doing the right thing within the law.
No. What I'm saying is, like, push that on the players. Like, okay, the system works, which means for you to actually be a vigilante, you're going to have to go pretty extreme.
So you're saying, like, in current modern society where, you know, police and the due process of court still actually does work overall, but it might not be expedient enough or severe enough for some people's tastes?
Yeah, exactly. Like, instead of doing the dystopian system where most players would choose, you know, to work outside the system, make it a really hard choice. Say, okay, you're going to be a vigilante. That means, yeah, you really have to be extreme.
You know, what you're saying there, Wayne, about, like, kind of the corrupt system, right? And it kind of made me think of just, like, system or setting in general. Shadowrun popped in my mind. And thinking is, like, do you think there are some games that pretty much encourage players to only play anti-heroes? An example would be Shadowrun.
Yeah. I was silent there because I was trying to think of another game.
Cyberpunk 2020. I'm a big fan of that system, and yeah, it's
which
the
is
same.
Just Shadowrun without fantasy. All right.
Yeah.
If you play in Chi-Town in Rifts, then yeah, you're basically playing in Nazi Germany. So definitely.
I think in Rifts, not exclusively anti-heroes, but yeah, definitely I could see where a lot of that game or that setting is encouraging anti-heroes. Vampire: The Requiem, I suppose, in many respects. You're kind of like a lot of times playing the classic Byronic hero. I guess the Byronic hero, yeah, which is a type of anti-hero. And that has a lot of the elements of cynicism, self-destruction, seduction, romance, you know, all this stuff.
I'll say you can in Vampire Requiem, but you could also, like, go, I think, the opposite way and, like, really support the hierarchy that's been put in place by vampire society.
But would that make you in any way heroic? To promote one of those societies or one of those covenants?
It would probably take a... This is going to sound like a cop-up, but it would take like a severe perspective shift. You would have to...
Or redefinition of the word hero.
yeah, that
Sorry,
too.
Dude,
I mean,
don't buy it.
I think I know where you're going with this. No, I think I know where you're going with this.
To your character, right, you would have to sort of fully embrace the... I guess, religion or structure or the idea that vampires are the top predator and therefore deserve to rule. And then you, to yourself and to that society, would be a hero, kind of. But it would be very difficult. Maybe not difficult, but it would be difficult for the player to kind of do that just because it would be such a different mindset between the character and the player.
I think I know where you're going with that, Wayne, but I still disagree because vampires have a stat called humanity and you're not supposed to treat humans as animals. That's what the whole humanity stat is. It's how human you still are. So I don't think that you could play somebody who's low enough on the humanity level, but I still don't think you're going to make them a hero.
Well, I'll say this. This is getting a little bit off topic, but for Masquerade, I had this book that was called Chaining the Beast. And it was a book of maybe like 10 or 12 or 15 completely different mindsets for vampires. And to get there, you had to essentially go down to a really low humanity score, then choose one of these paths, and then build it back up. And it being White Wolf, they had a lot of disclaimers in that book saying, hey, if any of these actually appeal to you as a person, please go seek mental help because this is purely fiction. But with those paths and those mindsets, if you made that change and if you embraced the tenets of whatever path you took, then your humanity score went up. So I would argue that in that case, you were a hero to the people who or the devotees of that path.
Okay, yeah, sure. It still sounds like a redefined hero, but it's all yours.
Yeah, I understand the point he was making there, but I guess if you look at like something like True Blood, and you look at, let's say, season one or season two, and you would say the Bill Compton character would actually be the hero.
Right.
Even though he is probably, his mindset's different than most other vampires.
Right.
Whereas the Eric character would be more anti-heroic as you get to know him and see what he does. Because his mindset is very much set in, you know, he's very much accepted that he is a vampire.
Right.
And then you watch the things he does, and it's against, I guess what you would say, his normal nature, which would be unheroic.
Mm.
Yeah. But yeah, sure, you could, in a way, you could say, like, yeah, you could be a hero in the sense, and I think that gets into a lot of other, like, when we talk about playing in a certain historical setting, sometimes you really have to do a perspective shift, and he goes, well, what is playing a hero? In this, what is a Roman hero?
Mm.
And it's not necessarily the same hero, or what we talked about at the beginning of this episode, what is a Greek hero? It's not Superman.
Mm, right.
Hector was not perfect if you read the Iliad. I mean, if you watch, like, Troy or you read children's stories, yeah, Hector is kind of like a tragic hero. But when you read the Iliad, he's a very selfish, vainglorious character. Mm-hmm. And also has some enormous heroic qualities. So.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. That was that sidebar. And that gets us into the next type of anti-hero, and that's the killer. And this is not the Punisher, so we make a real big distinction. The Punisher, who actually has a goal of killing criminals, and, you know, you could arguably noble goal, and he just uses lethal force to do that. So he's like a Batman with lethal force. Is the killer just kills. And Chris, you had a really good example of this.
Yeah, the one I thought of almost immediately was The Man with No Name, or Blondie. Some of the Clint Eastwood movies.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He's almost portrayed as, I think there's some film theories out there that he actually is playing the devil, or that he's playing some kind of mystical force of nature that just rolls into town like a natural disaster and destroys everything in its wake. And in the movies, of course, there is the plot towards where the kind of the good side ends, you know, the people fighting for their farmhouse are able to keep their farmhouse, that kind of Western story. But at the same time, there's nothing good or redeemable about him.
Yeah, I mean, he's got certain qualities that fall under other ones. I mean, he's the man with no name, so arguably you could say he's a bit of a void. And he is selfish. You can certainly motivate him with that. But no, one thing that he definitely has, a defining, he's a stone-cold killer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's no remorse, there's nothing. And he'll kill just about anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if you look at, like, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. The Bad was, you could just say, was an anti-hero as well in many respects.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was even more of a killer. We argued before the podcast about Dexter, if he was a killer or a vigilante, and we kind of, I guess, reached the compromise that he was at heart a killer who has put on the kind of the trappings of a vigilante to kind of
rationalize his killing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, that's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I think when you talk about a killer as a character, one of the distinctions that you have to decide for them is whether or not they do it in secret or in the open. And if it's in secret, then you have to figure out how do they keep it secret. And as we mentioned before, that, you know, secrets shouldn't be kept secret the whole campaign. Eventually it's going to come out and what you will do then. And if it's in the open, then you also have to figure how does the character reconcile this with society in general, or perhaps more importantly, with the other PCs in the party.
Can you actually do it, like a character playing a killer anti-hero, could they actually keep it secret from the rest of the party, and do you think that would be a good idea?
Yes to both, actually. From a previous campaign I played way, 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 way back when, one of the players played a rogue who was also secretly an assassin, and he did it with the DM on the side. So, you know, NPCs who would meet that for some reason he wanted to kill or he was contracted to kill, then he would run it as a side session with the DM, and that NPC would turn up dead. It took us a long time to figure out that he was the one doing it. When we did, it was an awesome reveal. It's really well done.
Huh. You saying that makes me revise my answer, because otherwise I think I would have said no.
Okay.
No, I think it was a good answer. I think what differentiates the killer between every other player. That a lot of times, like people, I mean, we've said this before. You know, even the paladin doesn't really reflect too much on the carnage.
Orc baby.
Yeah, just like that was wearing the black hat, so therefore I killed it.
It says right here in the book, lawful evil. What's the problem?
Yeah. I guess the big difference would be, you know, what kind of story you're building around. I think Chris just gave a good example of the hidden assassin storyline that you could do.
Yeah.
The others is, like, if you do have a character that kills openly and you want to play a killer anti-hero as opposed to every other player, you'll make that a part of, like, what that person does the other players don't really like so much. You know, they don't revel in it, or they're not all variations of the killer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Another question to ask is whether or not the person enjoys killing.
Ooh, that's good, yeah.
So you could have your sociopathic character that likes to kill, and that's what they found their callings in a way. Or you could take, like, a character from the James Ellroy novels called, like, Pete Buteron. And that's just what he does. I mean, he's a big guy who's been given this skill set, and that's a way for him to make money and live, you know? To a lesser extent, in another James Ellroy character, you could take Bud from L.A. Confidential, the Russell Crowe character, who is a tough guy, and they kind of use him. I mean, mostly in a non-lethal sense, but they kind of use him as a tool, and he accepts that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying almost play it like a professional, where just like this is kind of just what they do.
Yeah.
You know, actually, I really like that idea that you suggested a moment ago, Lyle, about how maybe this killer is a vital part of the team. You know, they need him around, even if what he does is disturbing to the rest of the players. And it could be even doubly so if it's one that enjoys what he does. You know, maybe it's, for example, in a Shadowrun game, if it's the cleaner who's got to go in and take care of, any witnesses afterwards. It's an important job, but yeesh.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And if it's somebody who doesn't enjoy it, like the Pete Buteron or the Bud character, then you have somebody who's like kind of reluctant to do it, but they know this is what they're supposed to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is their, in many respects, even though they're an anti-hero, this is now their role in society. This is how they fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And they derive no enjoyment from it necessarily. But people then use them.
Right.
I suppose that makes them easier to fit into the party, but then they're less comfortable in their own skin.
Mm-hmm.
No. Or they could be a little bit indifferent. They don't enjoy it. They're not terribly uncomfortable or reflective on it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just what they do. I mean, to them, it's like, you know, if you ask somebody, it's like asking a thief to pick a pocket, asking them to kill somebody.
Yeah, it could be one of those things where it's all they've ever known.
Yeah. And you're just like, did you do it? It's done. You want to talk about
maybe.
It?
Maybe.
No. Do you want to talk about it? Yeah.
No.
Go get the
tell me more.
Go get the information. There's that character in 24. He's a very minor character. I don't think he has any lines. And all he does is inject people with
sodium pentanol.
Sodium pentanol and that to like interrogate them. And it's just like, he inflicts pain. That's what he does.
Hmm.
And on that happy note.
So we'll go on to the happy anti-hero, the outcast.
Well, maybe he likes it better on the outside. Who knows?
A ball of joy that this guy is.
Or not.
Yeah.
I think for the outcast, there's a few things we can do with that. You can play the person, you know, like kind of brother from another planet, the ultimate outsider.
Hmm.
So people really react negatively. The Hulk.
Right.
In respect is the outcast. Like, society doesn't understand him, but he does a lot of good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if we brought him up earlier in the episode, but Wolverine, I suppose, could fit in this category.
Oh, I thought we were considering him for killer, but yeah, also the outcast as well. Like, he just doesn't fit.
Yeah, he's more of a self-exile than he is someone who's been outcast, but at the same time, yeah, he's still kind of on the outside.
And in many respects, this is probably the ultimate, is more heroic than the regular hero. If they then start engaging in, like, somewhat heroic activities, then they're kind of like, in spite of all of these disadvantages, then they're doing it. And I think that can be cool, the half-orc
mm-hmm.
Character in D&D that has many
prejudices against
prejudices, but all and limitations. But then also engaging in like heroic activities, like defending villages and stuff like that. So, I mean, this can be really a lot of fun. I think the difficulty would be to always maintain that outcast. I guess like a wagon train campaign would be all right because you're moving from place to place.
Yeah, good point. Because like if an orc saves enough villages, then those villages are going to remember him and not cast him out anymore.
Right.
I said this before for other things, but I think the outcast antihero, again, requires a lot of collaboration between the GM and the player. Because as you just said, Chris, you know, like the half-orc or the orc warrior who saves enough villages, eventually people are going to start liking him and he's not really going to be an outcast anymore. But, you know, you bringing up the Hulk cloud made me think of Hellboy, who I would say is another outcast antihero because he's scary. You know, because of his origins, people don't like him, but he's still trying to be a hero.
Yeah, that's a good one to bring up, Wayne. As an example, you could have an outcast who does his good deeds in secret so that no matter how many villages he saved, no one knows that he's the person that saved them, so they still won't treat him right. But I think another distinction you should make with them is whether these people have been outcast, like the Hulk, or whether they do it to themselves, like Wolverine. Because Wolverine could walk into a shop anywhere and nobody's going to say anything to him. He just seems like a regular guy. He's the one who's the jerk. But the Hulk, you know, he's big and green and scary, assuming he's angry.
Except for Wolverine's hair.
I could cover that up. But...
So.
Yeah. You could also do it as a group. I mean, the outcast is one where it is quite conceivable you could have a cast of outcasts. And there's been some good stories where the X-Men even. Like the, right. You know, they... Mm-hmm. And they still do these things, but you know they're heroes, but they're also anti-heroes in many respects because they're on the outside looking in.
Hey, yeah. Ninja Turtles! When you said they're heroes, the first thing that popped in my head was on the half shell. So,
and which is brings us to our next type, the half shell.
yes.
All right. Well, those are just some different types of anti-hero that you could play, and of course, this seems to be a pretty rich topic. So maybe something to revisit in a later episode, maybe in our next 100.
Yeah.
Day. We're coming up to our 100th episode.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, we're almost there. Hey,
exciting!
All right, time to quit podcasting.
Now we haven't jumped the shark yet.
Time to just take it easy.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website or stream it through Stitcher, download it through DriveThruRPG, or listen to it on iTunes. You can also post a comment there on the website. You can join us in the forums to have a discussion. You can follow us on Twitter or Facebook or send us an email because we're always glad to hear from you. And one more thing, if you're trying to join up in the forums and you don't hear from us, your account isn't activated, please do send us an email because we get a ton of spam, so we might have just missed yours.
Yeah.
And thanks, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.